Gilbert Gottfried has one of the most distinctive, some might say grating, voices in comedy today. He got his start in New York City doing impressions on the smallest of stages, but since then he's appeared on numerous television shows, movies, and commercials. And he's been the subject of some controversy fairly recently. He was on our show in April to discuss Rubber Balls and Liquor, his memoir about his early days on the comedy circuit, and we thought that we would rebroadcast that conversation for you today. Things started just as soon as I introduced him.
Yeah, just go out and get the book.
So are you going to do it in that voice or your real voice?
Yeah, this is my real voice. Sounds like Perry Como.
This is your first book. Have you had a lot more time on your hands recently?
Thank you. If any of you live in a cave or don't or on Mars, you haven't heard about it. Because of my tweets about the tsunami.
We'll get to that later.
Yeah.
But let's talk about happy things. When you got started in the business, did you imagine that you would ever write a book someday?
Oh, what? I just had someone talking into the mic. This is like public radio. So it's probably getting like a ship at sea talking. So what were you asking?
I was asking if you ever imagined you would write a book, or would you have written this one if you hadn't been asked to write it?
It's really all about being asked. It's just like I even say in the book how there are like movies get made because they got a deal. They get a deal. They get a distribution deal. They have a guy who's going to supply music, a company that'll supply music, and a director who owes them one more picture, and then an actor who owes them a film. And then at the last second, they go, okay, what should this be, a Western or a romance? That's what this book was like.
Did you find the process of writing the book much different from writing a stand-up routine?
No.
Just they longer.
Were, yeah, they were both unfunny. Yes.
Well, actually, at a certain point when you're writing the stand-up, I'm sure you check out the joke with other people. Did you do that here? Or do you kind of know what's going to be funny?
You never really know. You think you know. Like, you think after a while you've got an idea, and then it's like when it comes out of your mouth and people are staring at you, or then there's the setup and they'll start cracking up at that, and you never really know.
Well, they kind of see where the joke is going, with that setup. But you write that it took you a few years to even get into the habit of writing routines. You just trusted on your instincts at the time, or you had certain bits that you knew you could do?
I never really ever wrote stuff down. And then I'm actually miming writing on your desk with an imaginary pen. I never ever wrote stuff down. And it's like I would go in when I first went up on stage. I knew I could do some impressions, so I just did them. And then after a while of going up on stage, after a while I started screwing around up there, and I'd remember what got a laugh, and that was about it.
So you were improvising pretty much every night, but you were relying on impressions at that time.
Oh,
impressions have pretty much fallen by the wayside. Who did you do impressions of? I hope not Jimmy Cagney.
Oh. Well, that's one everybody has to do.
You dirty Ryan.
Yeah. It's like that's like the first impression everyone learns.
When I was a kid, everybody in my class wanted us to do an Al Jolson routine. They all thought that they sounded just like Al Jolson.
Do you know that I do a quick thing about Al Jolson?
Nobody knows what Al Jolson sounds like anymore.
Yeah, it's like. Like, it's funny, when I first got up on stage, I would do these imitations like Bela Lugosi and Groucho Marx and Humphrey Bogart, and it's like I realized that even back then, I was really dated in my references.
Because, you were doing what people who did impressions did.
Oh, yes, yeah.
So, were you considered the funny kid when you were young? Did you do this for your family?
I remember. Oh, and there's a part of this in my book that when I was a kid, I got into making papier-mâché puppets, and I made some papier-mâché puppets, And every now and then I'd put on a show for my parents where I'd put up like one of those little folding coffee tables, those little tin crappy coffee tables they used to have. And I'd throw a blanket over it and I'd put on a puppet show. And I remember I did one because I was into horror. So I did a puppet show of Dracula and a puppet show of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
Well, a lot of when I speak to people who become comics, they often start off as ventriloquists or doing magic or doing impersonations. In the end, they all wind up in the same place doing stand-up.
Oh, yes. Yeah. And the funny thing is there are some people that do impressions, and a lot of them, after a while, they hate themselves for it because you don't know who they are.
Yeah, well, Rich Little, do we have any sense of who he is as a person?
Yeah, it's like nobody.
In your book, you talk about meeting a lot of stars. Do you still get starstruck?
It's a weird thing. It's like when I'm walking down the street and people come up to me and recognize me, they seem like really awkward. And then sometimes they repeat themselves a question they just asked. Sometimes they'll come out with something stupid, sometimes something insulting, because they don't know you, but they want to talk to you. And then I realize when I meet celebrities who I don't know, I'm that guy. I'm the guy who's saying the stupid remarks and everything. And there are so many celebrities who I can't watch now because I remember meeting them.
And saying something stupid.
Yeah, yeah. And it's like, so you're sitting there watching like whoever, Laurence Olivier, and you're remembering something you said like, I asked him if he wears socks. Why did I do that?
You know? Well, you're faced with a couple of choices. People, you go up to somebody and say, I'm your biggest fan. That's what people often say. That's not memorable.
Yeah.
So you want to be remembered. You want this other person to recognize that you are also a human being. And so you say something stupid, but they will remember you.
Oh, yes. In the book, I talk about meeting Harrison Ford, which was, you know, you don't get to be a bigger star than that. And he liked me in The Aristocrats, and he complimented me. So rather than me just saying thank you very much and making a run for it, I wanted to talk to him. And so I figured, oh, I know, I'll start out with a joke. That'll really impress him. And you're trying desperately to think of something funny. So I look at Harrison Ford, and I go, thanks a lot. And you are? And I'm still not sure he got that I didn't know or I did. And so now I can't watch anything with Harrison Ford in it.
You better stop meeting people.
Yes.
Because you're not going to be able to see any movies, watch any television. You write, go to parties. You write, and there are other reasons why you might have problems too, which we'll get to again. You write about the many tears. I know you're unlikely to be invited to another roast. You write about the many tiers of fame. Do you worry that you might not reach the top tier?
Oh, yeah. It's like I talk about how the fame, it's kind of like there's those charts that show the national deficit, and the numbers are constantly changing like a hundredth of a second. It's like they're switching around. And that's the way it changes with fame. You know?
Although in your case, you're purposely being a little grating. And so the people who reach the top tier are people who we love, people who are nice and sweet,
yes,
aren't they?
And talented.
Well, that helps as well.
I had actually, I think it was David Steinberg, who I used to do in my head. But David Steinberg one time said to me, he goes, you should always be warm. Never be hot. If you're hot, you'll just burn out. If you're warm, you'll have a longer career.
And what's David Steinberg doing now?
Exactly.
How did the comedy act lead to all the other things that you've done, like the Hollywood Squares, the Cosby Show, a part in Problem Child, which you write about, even though the part was very small?
I started getting a reputation around the clubs, and like other comics would come in and watch, and I used to be the one that had prepared nothing and was always doing something crazy. And then the first big break I had that didn't become a big break was Saturday Night Live. Mm-hmm. Because that was like right after the original cast left.
And everybody was upset that these new guys were coming.
Oh, yeah. It's like, how dare they? You can't do Saturday Night Live without Belushi and Bill Murray. Now the cast changes in between commercial breaks. It doesn't.
Well, they start off with the people who are on the show, and they're about 25 people, maybe 30 some weeks.
Oh, yes.
And I don't recognize half of them, and I don't see half of them on the show.
No. And also, the most insane thing they were saying is, who are these new people? We don't know who they are. We never saw them before. And it's like they totally forgot they never saw Belushi or Bill Murray or Chevy Chase before.
Or Jane Curtin, whatever.
Yeah, any of those people.
But that then led you to be called for other things? Because you were Hollywood Squares for a long time.
Yeah, I was. Well, after that, there was like kind of a slow period where I was just looked upon as one of the people who killed Saturday Night Live. And then eventually, the next thing I got that was actually a break was they were at like Catch a Rising Star, some people from MTV, and they saw me and they said, we want to like tape you for just some, and I didn't even know what it was, for some segments. Could you come in? And I went in and they taped me and I just ad-libbed a whole bunch of stuff. They chopped it up. And they would show them throughout the day, you know, these quick, a couple of seconds here and there. And then they would start to introduce me as the general manager of MTV and the show. And that's where I started getting the most.
Some of the trouble started. Your last chapter is called Too Soon, about your Friars Club faux pas and the outrage that it caused because of the Empire State Building joke you made. That was at a Hugh Hefner roast.
I was at.
What was the general mood of the evening? Were people expecting jokes about sex with twins and the Playboy philosophy?
Well, it was a very weird one because I think they had canceled the date it was originally on, and this was like about a week after September 11th happened. And so there was a weird feeling in the room and all over the country, like people weren't sure they're supposed to laugh at stuff. And I want to be the first one to make a really truly tasteless joke.
And you did.
Yes, I did.
And you did. What happened when you made the joke and there was that pause before people started booing you?
Yeah. I made the joke, and it was the booing and gasping were immediate. And one guy yelled out, too soon. And I thought it meant I didn't take a long enough pause between the setup and punchline. So I sort of should have said 1, 2, 3, and then the punch. And then I followed it up by doing the Aristocrats, which is so
all tasteless.
Yes. And what gets me about that is the audience was completely offended by the September 11th joke, but jokes about incest and bestiality, well, that's fine. No.
But then more recently, you made your infamous jokes on Twitter about the Japanese tsunami, and I would have thought you would have learned your lesson from the Hefner roast.
Yes.
Did you know that you'd get fired from being the voice of Aflac Duck? Because that joke, did it occur to you that over 75% of Aflac's business is in Japan?
Yeah. Well, no one ever accused me of not being a schmuck. When I was doing it, it's the comparison I always make is it's sort of like you wake up in the morning and you eat your cornflakes and you don't think that's going to turn into a controversy and you're going to go, wait a minute, I've been eating cornflakes every day for my life. And so I was doing it that way.
Well, does this mean that you'll be writing more books now?
Hopefully. Or working in a bookstore.
Now, what does the title of the book, Rubber Balls and Liquor, mean?
Okay.
And you have to do it quickly.
Yes. Okay. Well, Rubber Balls and Liquor is one of the first dirty jokes you learn as a kid.
At least
the first one that I learned, where you tell a joke and you tell your friends, everything I say, you say rubber balls and liquor. Mm-hmm. So if you'll do that, I had breakfast today.
Rubber balls and liquor.
I had lunch.
Rubber balls and liquor. Are we going to get me in trouble with the FCC here?
You might.
No, I'm not doing it.
Well, keep saying that title.
We want Aflac to continue supporting public radio.
I've given up on anyone supporting me anymore.
In real life, they always say Howard Stern is quite different in real life.
Yes.
I assume you're soft-spoken.
Yes. I'm like, in real life, I'm like Bing Crosby.
The book, Rubber Balls and Liquor, is published by St. Martin's Press. Thank you for being with us again.
Oh, thank you.